The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on February 12, 2023. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everybody. Good to see you. It's been a while since I've given a talk at Dharma Field. I'm sorry I'm not in the building today for various reasons, but I'm glad I'm able to give the talk. I just want to start out by pointing out that of the five major religions in the world, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and then also Buddhism and Hinduism. Basically, I think they're the ones that would be listed. But of the five, Islam is the actual word that forms its name. Islam in Arabic means submission. It's built right into the name. That's what Islam means. And I'm not going to be knocking anybody here or anything of that sort. That's perfectly fine. But it would be, in the case of Islam, I think that would be submission to God or God's will, something of that sort. And it's perfectly fine for those who might believe that, but that's what it would take. If you believe you have some idea about God, you have some belief along those lines, and that God has will, something of that sort. And if you believe that, I mean, if you think this is true and real, then to follow the tenets of that religion, you would submit to the will of God, or Allah, as they would say in Arabic. And that's perfectly fine. However, Buddhism, which I'll be speaking of here, and Zen, has something kind of similar to that, this idea of submission, but it's radically different. And that's what I'd like to talk about today. It's radically different in some very subtle ways. And I hope maybe I can bring that out. A few weeks ago, in our Wednesday night classes that we've had, various students from around the country and parts of the world have been giving talks on Wednesday nights, and they're very good, every one. And I'm not going to, again, I'm not going to criticize anything here at all, but it was, one of the students gave a quote of another Zen teacher who I know fairly well, and I have a lot of respect for his teaching. But it was quoted that he had said or written somewhere, I hadn't seen it myself, but that he said that in Zen or in Buddhism, we have to surrender to the teacher. And he may have said that, but of course we have it in a limited context. There are really no context at all. And there might be other things we could say about that. But there is this matter of surrendering. But I would say it's not to a teacher. It's not to some seen authority out there or anything of that sort. This isn't what we need to surrender. If we're interested in waking up, becoming sane, becoming enlightened, awake to, and we don't become enlightened, we're really already here. But it's a matter of just realizing this and waking up to this. But in doing this, something needs to be surrendered, but not to a teacher. If it's a true Dharma teacher, a Dharma teacher is like a catalyst. They're not an authority. They're not something that you will get something from. You know how a catalyst would work, like in a chemistry experiment. You use a catalyst to kind of move the experiment along. It causes the interactions to take place. And at the end, new substances form there or whatever, but the catalyst is still sitting there, unchanged. And that's what a catalyst is. And I would say a Dharma teacher is more like a catalyst to maybe help you through this process of where something's going to change in you, or at least the change would be come to some true realization of reality and what's taking place here. A Dharma teacher is one who may be able to facilitate that in some way, but not actually giving you something or asking you to believe in something, and certainly not to submit or to surrender yourself to the teacher or anything of that sort. But there is a kind of surrendering that we talk about. Something is, I don't know, given up or handed over or whatever. And that is our views. And what we do is, what you're surrendering to is you're surrendering to the Dharma. You're surrendering to reality, to truth. But in order to do this, or it's not even in order to do it, what it is you're letting go of the kind of packaged ideas and beliefs and customs and your likes and dislikes, all of this. You just kind of set them down. You let them go. You don't have to destroy them or anything like that. Maybe you can use them temporarily for this or that. But in the end, you don't hold on to some view that you might have, some belief you might have, some notion that you think you might have received from a teacher. If you did receive something, now this is something of your own making. You don't actually receive anything from the teacher. The teacher's just a catalyst, still going to remain just what you had before you started, but something that might help you in your musings and your ponderings and all of this, to maybe stop all of that and to wake up to what's actually taking place in this moment. And this is really what we're talking about. But it doesn't involve ideas or beliefs or conjectures of various kinds or opinions or theories or, you know, hypotheses. There's no speculation in it and wondering, well, could it be this, or did the teacher mean that? In a sense, a true Dharma teacher doesn't really mean anything other than just pointing something out about what's actually taking place. And what is actually taking place is something other than what we conceptualize or what we package in our minds as various ideas and things, objects out there in the world as well. It is not anything like this at all. It is not objective. But it is also not subjective. And that's why the teacher, you know, if you have a teacher who is trying to sell you something or trying to get you to do something or to believe in something or to think something, start looking at that. Make sure. It still could be a true teacher, but be careful, because if that persists in any way, that's just ordinary stuff again. A true teacher isn't going to really, in the end, be asking anything of you. They're just trying to help you wake up. That's all. And you might wonder, well, what's in it for them if I wake up or not? Well, that's one of the things you'll wake up to. It's this world of suffering and pain and confusion. That's as much for anyone who sees reality, sees Dharma. That's what's taking place right here now. It's not in something else over there or someone else over there. It is just this right here. So this is what they do. To the extent that one is living out of awakeness, this is what you do. And it acts as a catalyst for others who might be confused. And that's all. If you think, for example, that I'm trying to get you to believe something particular, I'd like to have you tell me what you think it is, because I'll do my best to disabuse you of that, whatever it might be. I'm just trying to help you to notice what's going on in your mind and how it is that we grasp and how it is that we'll even try to grasp at, say, a talk like this that's unfolding right now. You might assume that I have things here that I want you to take away and to digest and to assimilate and maybe to identify with or something of that sort. This isn't my concern, and I would just assume that you don't do that, but maybe you can't help but do that because that's what we're used to doing. But I would ask you to examine that, continue to look at that, and you can ask yourself if that's correct. And I'll tell you just point blank that that is not what I'm doing. That's not what I'm intending to do, at least. But now I'm asking you to believe something, and I don't really care to do that. I would say just continue to look as you should in all cases with whatever it is that you encountered. You need to be, most of all, looking at your own mind and realizing the kind of grasping and the solidifying of this or that within the experience, thinking that this is true and this is, you know, how it is. I am something particular, we will think, you know, because we see all those particular things out there. It seems like we do, and that there's even an out there, looks this way, and I don't think that we should carry on in the world as if that weren't the way that things are, because it certainly looks that way. But we have to start to understand that it actually isn't really that way, even though we can't say that it is not that way. And we have, and that's why we have this saying in Zen that you know, things are not as they seem, nor are they otherwise. The problem here is that look at the grasping that's taking place. Either we think it's this way, or we want it to be this way, or maybe we think, well, Steve is saying it's not that way. I'm not exactly saying it's not that way. Can't say it's not that way. If it seems that way, it looks that way, tastes that way, feels that way, that's the experience. But it's a mistake to think that that's a particular way or a particular thing, and that I'm something in particular as well. Even though everything about me, as I try to reflect on the past as I recall it, there was never a moment like this right here. And the thoughts or feelings or understandings I might have in any given moment that I recall, that isn't this here now. And that's the same for all of us. There's nothing there to grasp. But what you have to get familiar with then is your grasping and what you're taking hold of here. But as my teacher, Katagiri Roshi, used to say, though, about this matter of, say, surrendering, just kind of giving up whatever it is you're hanging on to, or at least loosening your grip on it a little bit, and realize that you are gripping something, just that alone goes a long way. But loosening that up a bit, but my teacher used to say that we're full of resistance, is what he was saying, but he pronounced it resistance. You know, he always met with a bunch of resistance from his students, you know. And I used to feel, too, when I first heard him using this term, that I didn't feel like I was resisting anything. I was pretty open to whatever it was he was saying, for the most part. Occasionally, I'd be questioning some things, which is a good thing to do, really. But I could see that he was seeing stuff that seemed to resonate with truth that I hadn't encountered before, or thought about, or noticed. And so I was trying to stay open to whatever it was he was saying. But he was talking about resistance, and I think there were students who would more openly and defiantly resist maybe what he was pointing out or saying, and that's fine. That's quite understandable, maybe even kind of healthy to some degree. But if what you're encountering is true Dharma, and there's somebody there who is able to point that out to you, what you have to notice is this resistance within yourself. I started to realize that even though I didn't feel like I was resisting anything for the most part, I was pretty much open to what he said and what he directed me to do or something, some form of the practice or something. And I would follow that without resisting, and yet I started to realize that there were elements in my mind here that were still fighting, resisting, not willing to give up deep-seated beliefs and ideas, notions, habits of thought and behavior that I had, and not looking at these things. Because this resistance that he's talking about is really quite thorough and all-penetrating. It has to reach into pretty much everything that we're hanging on to, and this includes the things that in any given moment we might not realize that we're really hanging on to and thinking that reality is constructed in the way that we have it framed up in our minds. So this is quite subtle, and it's thorough, it's complete, about what it is we need to awaken to and to realize what it is that we're hanging on to that's blocking us and keeping us from really waking to what is taking place here. So what I'm talking about here now then is this kind of a, I don't know, submission. maybe that's too strong a word, but this surrendering. And I think this is what the teacher might have been talking about. We don't surrender, again, like to a teacher. We don't really surrender to anything in particular. We just surrender. We just give up the kind of stuff that we're holding on to. And little by little begin to realize the subtle levels and the degrees to which we are gripping things and holding things. But this is why we do have teachings. You know, I've given you plenty of times, particularly more recently, like where Dogen says of his monks, you know, he says, I tell you the reason you don't wake up. And he's just saying here, point blank, the reason you don't wake up is because you're holding views. You don't give up your views. You don't relinquish them. And there's other teachings, too. It might show up in various ways, like in the Xin Qing Ming, where Sen Sang, he writes that the wise have no motives. A true Dharma teacher has no motive. They're not trying to do anything in particular. Maybe we can say, well, to help you wake up, but that's not something particular. And there's not a whole lot that they can do other than point out the things for you. But there's no motives behind that, really, other than to alleviate the pain in the world, which the Dharma teacher is living out as well as you and everyone else. But the wise have no motives, but fools, Sen Sang says, fools shackle themselves. We shackle ourselves with all the baggage, all the stuff that we're hanging on to. And in particular, the stuff that's still there that we don't even realize we're hanging on to. Like, for example, that you're sitting here now and viewing a particular talk. You know, and maybe most of you know that here I am. I'm talking to you now, and I'm in Minneapolis. But through the technology of modern science and engineering and all this, where you can be sitting anywhere. I can see some of you I know happen to be in other lands across oceans and elsewhere. You're viewing this right now, a different time of the day for you than it is here. All of that is taking place. And we can say that, well, I know this. You know, I know that this is true. And we can't say that it is not. It certainly looks this way. It seems this way. It sounds this way. And we can interact this way and even carry on fairly complex and intelligent conversations through large distances and seemingly different times, depending on where we see the sun right now or don't see the sun. And we can all kind of understand this, and we'll think that this is true. But if you hang on to that, even a notion such as that, or just this notion of I myself here, wherever here happens to be for us, if this is in your mind framed up in such a way, and it's just there, you don't walk around with this in your conscious mind all the time. You don't wake up thinking things of this sort at all. But it is there as a belief, as an understanding, as a framed up idea that you have of how the world is and how you move through it and what you're going to do today and any number of things. And that's real enough. But what it is that a Dharma teacher will be pointing out to you, and in terms of the surrendering, is not to the teacher, but to surrender that deep belief that you might have. But this is what we need to wake up to and to realize. Things is subtle in just this very way. But also to realize that as you're sitting there, I'm facing a computer screen with a lot of your faces and names. I like it when I can see your faces, but that's okay. I'm shy too, so I don't like to. Anyway, but the way we frame things in our mind, what I'm trying to help you with here is to realize the depth to which this goes. And I can tell you, I'll point to this, but you can find this for yourself, though, but that there's no bottom to this. This is what the conscious mind is that there's something showing up here. And as soon as there's something showing up here, no matter what it might be, not necessarily another person or a tree or a thought or a feeling, but anything at all, and with that, Now here's the viewer, me, or the listener, or the taster, or whatever, the thinker, the feeler, whatever it might be, this is there with it. And this is what consciousness is. It is just that. It doesn't mean that there's something corresponding to the thinker, or what's being thought, or to the object being seen or touched or whatever it might be. That's not actually in the experience. What we're talking about, what I'm trying to point to here, is the actual perceptual experience, what we might call just the pure awareness, that the mind is turned on, that this is not nothing. Clearly, if something's showing up here, even just one little atom of something, this is consciousness. There's something appearing there. But with the careful examination of that, and we see that this is just a mental construct, we can't really say that there's anything at all there in particular. After all, it doesn't last, not even a nanosecond. Already, it's gone, whatever that was. And what does that refer to anything at all, ever, at any point? Or it, or I, or you, or whatever. It's a matter of then just seeing this. And at some point, if you really settle down and examine, just observe what is actually taking place here without thinking about it, because thinking about it is just going to make more constructions, that becomes something solid in our mind, even if it's just a thought or a belief, it becomes quite solid. But we don't notice that, and we'll mistake that for something that's real unto itself, rather than the fleeting experience of this moment, which is already gone. By the way, this is also life. This is the life of this moment, is just that. And it's not something really other than consciousness itself. But that's the world of constructs. It's the world of creating and destroying concepts. And that's different from the percept, the perceptual experience, which is just simply that this is on, that this is not nothing. And this is what we can finally awaken to and to see, but that itself is not awakening. That's not enlightenment, is to finally see that, but to realize that that is not other than the world that is appearing in the conceptual, in the graspable, in the out-there-ness, in the me-here-ness. This is the expression of it. This is the taste of it, the feel of it, the sense of it, which is not nothing. But at the same time, we can understand that it's not nothing, it's not anything in particular, and it's not nothing. This is what we can come to. We only come to this by relinquishing our view. This is why we have Dogen saying something like that, and others as well. I should have jotted down some different expressions, but you've encountered these things, and I've given you plenty over the years, so. But that's why we have these kinds of pointings in our teachings. They're pointing to something like this. But what I'm trying to get across this morning is the thoroughgoing nature of this. And this is also referred to as perfection. So we have the perfection, teachings of the perfections in our teachings. This was mentioned just recently now that in one of the classes, I forget now, but that's the understanding of perfection. Like the perfection of wisdom is to see this thoroughly and completely, and full realization of that. And the perfection of wisdom is compassion as well, because this is right there with it, can't be separated from it in any way. But this is what our teachings are constantly pointing to. But we'll grasp them. We'll get ideas about what wisdom means, or what perfection means, or compassion, or all the various things, but as well as more concrete-like things that we can grasp. But all of that is in the world of the conceptual. That is all consciousness created. It's this function of mind which is dividing everything, one thing from another. And there's a great deal that can be said about that, which I won't be taking up here. Anyway, so it is a matter of settling down to this. But the way, but a way that will facilitate this, like a catalyst, you know, can facilitate this in some way. And one of the cleanest and the slickest ways to do it is just simply to begin to, and I mean continue, to observe your mind. Not in a way where you're blocking or stopping anything. You're not saying something is right or wrong or good or bad. I should do this and I shouldn't do that. None of that kind of stuff. Just see what is actually unfolding there. And it will reveal its true nature, which is that it is empty of any kind of substantiality. It is empty of, well, being. And yet at the same time, its true nature also being, as I was saying, this being revealed there, is that this is not time, because here it is. Here it is, whatever it is. And we might identify it, and it's useful to maybe put a name on it, if it's a person or a thing or whatever, and talk in that way. But the mistake would be that we think that the name or the label or whatever it is actually applies to some objective reality out there. This is the mistake, which I'm not saying it's a mistake, because that's not the case, that it's not an objective reality out there. This is important, but this is also impossible to conceptualize. But I'm not saying that it is not that, because here it is. But if you continue to observe it, you'll see that it doesn't have any enduring or substantial characteristics of its own, nor does it last. Which is what we think existence is. Well, this thing here, but it exists. I see it. It's going on from moment to moment. Well, if you look very carefully, there isn't anything that's actually going on from moment to moment. There isn't any actual identifiable moment to moment, actually. And yet at the same time, it looks this way, seems this way, feels this way, sounds this way. But the only way this will jump out at you so you can see it, is if you can relinquish your views. I don't know that you can relinquish all of them altogether at once for any given second. I don't know that I can. But if you let enough of them drop away, they become weak enough so that they aren't going to be constantly keeping you here in this samsaric world of coming and going and persisting and, you know, dying and all of that. Let's see, did I have something else? Oh, I was going to say this here, too, that recently I was interviewed with a rabbi, a very interesting fellow, very open, and we had some really good discussions and things. And at one point I brought up that we have this teaching of to relinquish our views, and he said, there's one thing about a teaching like that, to relinquish your views or to, you know, drop your views or whatever. He said that then you have to drop the view that you must drop your views, you know. And so one of the views you have to relinquish is the idea of dropping your views. Yeah, that's definitely the case. And so that poses another problem that shows up in all sorts of ways with trying to teach what it is that I've been attempting to point out here, and it's usually in one way or another, that's what I'm trying to do, is to point out some of this in various ways. But the problem is that whatever we say, whatever we put there, is something that it's not meant for you to take it up, like, ah, okay, so this is what it is. You have to drop that as well. So what's happening here, like in the case of Dogen saying or my saying, and I'm not saying it because Dogen's saying it, I'm telling you because I see this for myself, but Dogen says it, and as well as many other teachers, one way or another, and you can too. There's nothing special or magical about it, but this matter of take a teaching like relinquish your views, this is what you need to do. If you want to wake up, says Dogen, then this is what you have to do. And then as the rabbi points out, yeah, but one of the views you have to give up is this idea of dropping your views. And he's absolutely correct. Yes. So don't hold the view that you have to relinquish your views. All I'm pointing out is just realize what that is. That you're holding views is a view that, or that if you want to awaken, you're going to have to drop that view. But now you might have the idea that, okay, so Steve says that, yeah, if I want to awaken, then I have to drop this view. And yeah, and I did say something like that, but I don't mean for you to hang on to that. This is just a matter of looking at what's unfolding in the moment. It's just simply something of that sort. There's nothing holy about the idea of relinquishing your views. It's just that, as Dogen points out, if we do this, you know, if you can relinquish your views, you stand a very, I don't know, good chance, but better, far better chance of waking up to what these views are. And I mean, in and of themselves, and that they aren't anything at all in a way, as a substantial thing, objective thing out there at all. You can begin to see that this is the nature of these views, and you start to realize that, well, everything that I believe or think is real and solid about the world is of this view that I'm holding here, including myself as the holder of this view. This is how we wake up to this, is just simply by looking at it. It's as simple as that. Which you can say, well, yeah, but that's a view. Well, if you want to keep playing that game, that's fine. But you're ignoring what the spirit of this directive, this, well, it's not even a directive, but this, what's being pointed out there, is about. So it is something of that, and it's very light-handed. Unfortunately, our words and our speech and our phrases and things like this, are the ideas that we espouse with our words and things, these aren't light-handed generally. They're very weighty and heavy. Sometimes they might just seem like bubble-headed. Okay, so they might be light and you let them float away. But there's plenty of other views left that we're holding in all sorts of subtle ways that we don't even realize are there within our mind that keep us bound and captured in a world that's otherwise very confusing and frightening and painful, but that we could become relieved of all of that sort of confusion if we just learn to see directly what the actual experience of this moment is. And the actual seeing of this moment for what it is doesn't even hold I or me for each of us. You might think, well, that would be a terrible thing if I'm disappeared. Well, nothing disappears. It's still going on. It's the confused idea about what a word like that is referring to. That becomes very clear. It's not referring to anything at all in particular. Nothing has changed in a sense. It's just the clarity of mind is suddenly there. But it is a matter of seeing that and not thinking it. If you have the idea, okay, I realize, so there's no me here then. But that's just an idea. That's not good enough. That's just ordinary stuff again. It's the actual direct, immediate realization that nothing's being held here at all. Now you understand, mind and consciousness stop being mysteries, and same thing with life and death stops being a mystery. All of this sort of thing, there's great freedom in this, the perfection, thoroughgoing nature of it, which can be realized without even having to do this perfectly, to ever relinquish every single view. All the time. I don't know that that can ever occur. Well, maybe I've gone on long enough here. Perhaps you might have a question or an argument about anything I said here today. I know it sounds pretty strange. This is something that's radically different. So there is this relinquishment, this submission, this giving up. It's not really submission, I wouldn't say, but surrendering. But certainly not surrendering to a teacher or even to the teaching itself. It's just opening the hand. As Uchiyama Roshi says, opening the hand of thought. Just opening it. That's it. And if we can continue to do this, well, yeah, you might have to grip an idea or thought to get through your day, you know, to go shopping for groceries and driving your car, whatever the day calls for, yeah, well, that's fine. But there's this deeper layer of where we think there's substance to this that isn't really there, and that we can finally realize about it without ignoring it, without carrying on as if there isn't my automobile here going down the street and I'm driving it, you know. But that requires an awful lot of hanging on to certain views momentarily, but they don't have to become that view of that this is ultimately what's real. Ultimately, that isn't what's real. What's real is that here it is, yes, but without substance. And now this is life. This is consciousness. This is mind. These things cease to be mysteries. If you think the foundation of reality is of the physical, you're a physicalist, now these things remain a mystery. You know, all kinds of people working on this and trying to build conscious machines and various things, just laboring away over something that just you'll never put together, because that isn't the nature of what's taking place here. This is mind with a capital M. This is reality. This is what Wang Po refers to as the one mind. And he says there's only the one mind, besides which nothing exists. And I remember I used to puzzle over that until finally I could see for myself just what he was referring to. So I wouldn't be dismissive of Wang Po. That's a very direct pointing to the true nature of what is taking place here. Were it not of this sort, then nothing would be taking place. But clearly, this isn't nothing. Here it is. What is it? Yeah, we'll try to put something there. That's where you don't need to do. You need to see that you can't put anything there. You don't have to, because this is it. But it is without substance. That's how you can have it. That's what mind is. That's what consciousness is. The thing that's holding the whole, this is the perceptual. All the rest of it, the broken out stuff, that's the conceptual, where we conceptualize. Well, it's not that we conceptualize, we're one of the constructs, the conceptual constructs. But this is the functioning of consciousness, which is a function of the whole. Okay, I see a hand here. Maybe I can find Scott.
Steve, thank you for a great Dharma talk. I really appreciate it, and for your writings as well. My question is, when you as a teacher come to give a Dharma talk to us, and you're talking about letting go of fixed ideas, isn't just the fact that you are sitting there looking at what to teach, aren't those teachings that you're looking at a some sort of fixed idea? And the second part of that would be, I'm really, since I'm studying Dogen right now, and I'm having a problem of finding how he wants us to let go. If you could comment on that a little bit, I'd be very appreciative. Thank you.
Okay, well, now I forgot your first question, but in terms of Dogen, yeah, how he wants us to let go. Very often you might find in Dogen, particularly in something like Busho, Buddha Nature, he doesn't give you very much to hang on to there. And, you know, but even in other teachings of Dogen, Dogen is, you know, very good at this. But he'll come up with these incredible, poetic, beautiful, fantastic images and things of this sort. It isn't just to create the beauty or the poetry, or maybe sometimes even the ugliness or the frightfulness of maybe some of the images that he might come up with. It isn't really that at all, but to realize that you aren't going to be able to, in the end, form an image or create a graspable concept, you know, whether it's something that has an appearance that he might be describing, you know, as six heads and I don't know what, eight arms or something, like you might find in Busho there. But it isn't. See, the mistake is, I think, and I probably make this mistake more than I should, because I know better, but. Where I'll try to give, say, my readers or even you listening, I want to help you to see something, so I try to make it very clear, but then in making things as clear as I can make them, I'm also maybe spelling out a little bit more than I should, and so it makes it more graspable, and then maybe you feel like, okay, I kind of get, okay, I get what you're saying there. But it isn't a matter of that. I don't want you to get some particular thing. Really what I'm trying to help you with, and maybe if I try to make something clear, but it's just to notice that the clutter that was just there, maybe before, maybe I've done something here that might help to clarify it a little bit, but just to realize that even with this clarification here, that clutter, which now can just kind of fade away if you really see through to this point, I want you to understand that this is still clutter. There's stuff there that you can still grip. In the end, I want to help you to notice that, because in the end, I, if we say anything at all, we are putting something there that potentially can be gripped, even if it's eight heads and six arms or whatever. But the reality that we're faced with, while it looks like we can grip it in all sorts of ways, but the reality is we can come to realize that actually at any moment here we can't get hold of anything. And that is why we have it, so to speak, even though we don't really have it, but here it is. And it, why is this vibrant here it isness that we're living in all the time is the way it is, and as vibrant as it is because we can't grip it. That then strikes as being a mystery. Well, what's this all about? Why are we here? What is consciousness? What is mind? And it's all like a mystery to us in the end. We'll go in and maybe we'll tinker around with things, and then we can end up writing a book like Consciousness Explained or something like this, which has been done. That was done back in 1994 or something like that. Even though people have noticed since then, what is it, consciousness is still a mystery, at least for people who go about trying to piece it together that way. As opposed to, if you want to understand what consciousness is, just look at it and don't think. As soon as you think, now you're using the constructs of consciousness to try to figure out what consciousness is. Just notice what's happening here. And notice that in the end, you can't grip it. But far from that, including yourself, there's no particular thing here that's me that's experiencing. And that might seem a little scary until you realize this very vibrant thing that we call, we might think of as my life, that's why it's being experienced. But if we're still interpreting it as my life, we're still not fully understanding the true nature of it, because it is the life of the world, or the life of totality, is really what's taking place here. And of course, then that's back earlier when I asked, you might ask, you know, what's in it for a Dharma teacher then if they're trying to help people? Well, it's just that very thing. they would realize, if it's true, one who sees Dharma realizes, my life isn't mine here, it is all of that out there, and there's a great deal of suffering. So there's a lot of work to do, things that you can do to help point out. You can't cure it, though, I don't think, or that's not the way to look at it. No, I don't know. I think I might have wandered a bit from your question. And as for your first part of the question, I'm afraid as a younger man, I could hang on to stuff like that, but I'm starting to realize I'm losing that ability. Was there another part of the question I missed?
The first part of the question is, you know, when you're talking, when you're giving a Dharma talk and you're talking about here and now, opening the hand of thought, isn't just the fact that you have that concept in mind as a fixed concept to give to us, isn't that hanging on?
Well, it could be, but I'm not hanging on to any particular desire to hand you that as a fixed concept. In fact, I didn't know I was going to refer to that in my talk today, but in the way the talk was moving and flowing, that is something that I'm familiar with, and I think many of you are as well. So I just pointed to that as a way to maybe help you get some sense of what it is that I'm speaking of or pointing out. But it wasn't pre-planned or anything of that sort. I had a general, it's always like this for me when I give talks like this. Dharma talks. And this is what a Dharma talk is, something that's really not all that planned out or written out or structured out. But I have a general sense of what it is I want to bring out today in my talk, and then I ran through some ideas in my mind. I took a couple little notes here just to remind myself of things that crossed my mind before I gave the talk now. Otherwise, I just sit down and pretty much just speak. I know what it is I want to say in regards to pointing out the nature of reality is such that we can't grip it, and so we need to set that down. But then I just begin to talk. I think probably what triggered some of these ideas, which I didn't know if we would end up as a talk like this or not, but it did ultimately, I guess, was the idea that there was a teacher who said that you must surrender to the teacher. And I thought, okay. And I happen to know this particular person, and his teaching is very good. You know? And he might have said something like that, but it might have been in a larger context or something else. Or he might have just, for the time being, or momentarily misspoke. I certainly misspeak myself at times. And I go back and listen to my talks or whatever, and I think, oh my gosh, did I say that? I didn't mean that. Anyway. So, but there was no fixed thing that I had in mind. There never is, not when I give a talk. I don't have notes. I just have a few little notes in front of me, but generally I don't even have notes, you know. But I do know what it is I want to focus on and try to point out that day. I do have something in mind. What I'm going to say about it, I never know for sure.
Okay. Thank you. So you're giving the thought, but you're not holding on to it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And whatever I do say, if you want to counter me on something, well, I can deny it the next time around and give it to you from another angle. But that sounds rather arbitrary. It's not really that, but everything we say is flawed, you know, because we can't speak truth. You can't get truth into words. Mm-hmm. But words can be... Oh, and by the way, too, I'll be teaching a course here now in March. The four Tuesdays in March, I'll be giving a class on words, it's on understanding and using a vocabulary of enlightenment, and it was the title of the course. And that'll be this... in the month of March, Tuesday nights, and you're all welcome to sign up for it if you want or whatever. Now, what was I saying? words are pointers. You know, we can use them in certain ways, even though we can't speak truth, we can't put it into words. Words can be used in a way to direct our attention to some very subtle things that we might not otherwise realize. I mean, how can you say, I mean, we have a phrase like I use it today, things are not as they seem, nor are they otherwise. Well, what exactly is being said there now? But now that is directly pointing, pretty directly pointing to what's going on here. But what exactly are we saying? What exactly is that saying? Our conceptualizing mind, the conceptual now, will try to grip it. Try to get a grasp of it. Oh, so you have an idea now in your mind. Ah, now I see. But that's bondage. That's when Sensong says fools shackle themselves. That's what we're doing now with that. So it's just a matter of that's pointing to something. Just see where your gaze might fall. But don't pick up anything there. But just notice something there. If you return to these kinds of teachings that are pointings, without trying to figure them out. I remember in the early days where I was trying to figure out Nagarjuna, say, I feel like my brains were steaming or something, you know, steam coming out of my ears kind of a thing. And finally I realized this isn't the way to go about this. And it's just a matter of just kind of read it in a relaxed way, if it's true Dharma, and then come back to it. And come back to it again. Oh, okay, I see there's another hand up. Yeah, Jamie. Isn't that Jamie?
Yeah, hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
I can, yeah. It's getting late, so yeah, but please go ahead.
Yeah, I'll keep it brief. This is a question I think that I'm going to struggle to put into words properly anyway, but it's something about when we talk about conceptualizing or the conceptualizing mind as opposed to perception Is it that are we saying somehow in conceptualization it feels like there's an element of choice? Somehow it feels like that to me. But on the other hand, I know I feel like you've said at the same time that conceptualization itself is a function of consciousness, is a function of mind. So it almost makes me feel, if I think about it in a certain way, that the delusion that we are experiencing has its origins in mind itself.
Oh, so, yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm... It's yes. Kind of a strange situation that on the one hand, we're trying to apparently move back into pure perception from
but you don't have, you're already in pure perception. It's just a matter of waking up and realizing that's where you are. We always have, yeah, go ahead.
But are we, so it's a matter of waking up into seeing where we already are, but where we already are in this conceptualized broken up world is also a function of this one mind as well. Is that?
Oh,
is
yes.
That,
yeah. Yeah. As Wang Po says, there's only the one mind, you know. So
in some way, we don't need to stop seeing this in a broken up way.
No, we don't. This is, it's never a matter of giving up the conceptual. We need the conceptual. It's very functional and useful. It's just that it's not ultimately, the stuff that seems to be behind it, which we take to be ultimately real, you know, that there really is a desk in front of me here and all that sort of thing, that's not ultimately real. It's real enough, so we can't ignore it. You know, I can't just get up now and start walking as if there's not a desk in front of me, you know, so... And certainly not step out in front of a bus, that kind of thing. So we can't ignore that at all. It's real enough, but it's not ultimately. That's not really what's going on. Because if you in the all kinds of ways of doing this in my book, The Grand Delusion, I take you through a number of ways. But if it's a physical reality, certainly, just even moving in for a close look, we end up with the whole thing kind of evaporating right before our very eyes. You'll never get hold of any substantiality there in the conceptual.
Thank you.
That's okay then, Jamie?
Yes, thank you, Steve. Sorry, the connection is just breaking, but thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think this is it. I don't see another hand here, so and we have used up the hour. So thank you very much. It was good to talk with you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.